This month's featured nutrient at drhoffman.com, EGCG Ultra, bringing you the benefits of green tea in a concentrated form. For all your supplement needs, shop our store at drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it's time for a feature which is one of your favorites, which is our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin, of course, is our Hoffman Center nutritionist. She's a registered dietitian. She also has earned a master's degree in nutrition, and she sees patients with me on a daily basis at the Hoffman Center. She also has an independent practice within the Hoffman Center, so if you want, you can come see Layla and get some great advice. So welcome, Layla. How you doing?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, good. So pretty pleasant weather this summer so far.
Yeah.
Not super sweltering days. That's a relief.
Not yet, yes.
And so, you know, with a promise of warmer days to come, but at least, you know, we're officially launched. All right. So before we get to our questions, and we have several, by the way, you can email us your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. Radioprogram@AOL.com gets you through to us, and we will endeavor to answer as many of your questions as we can. But before we get to that, a couple of news stories today. One has to do with the BMI as a measurement tool for children. Actually, the headline of the story is that we may be underestimating the epidemic of obesity among kids. I mean, which is scary because we already, you know, lots and lots of news stories these days about, you know, kids are fatter, kids are more pre-diabetic. And
yeah,
this story suggests that we may be underestimating the extent to which that's true. What's your take on that?
I believe that we are, because BMI is not a great tool for estimating any of that. You could be a normal BMI and be over fat, which is one of the points of this article. Actually, so it's not a great tool for determining whether you're over fat, have the right amount of fat, or under fat, really.
Well, you know, this is a big study, and it's like a study of studies, a meta-analysis, and I, for the life of me, I can't see why they keep using the BMI. So explain the BMI and explain the origins of it, and, you know, what's the problem
with
the BMI?
BMI, body mass index, it's actually an indicator of whether you're underweight, overweight, or obese, and basically it's taking a height and weight measurement. You take your body weight in pounds, and you divide it by your height in inches squared. So,
and by the way, the historical
height.
Note:
then,
a guy who came up with it, his name is Quetelet. Quetelet.
Mm.
This is actually a good crossword puzzle word. Quetelet. You get a lot of points, or Scrabble word, because it starts with a Q. And he developed this in the 19th century. You know, so like how?
Really?
Yeah. So he was like a mathematician. So he came up with a way to, you know, supposedly measure obesity, you know, just like an equation. And it's, you know, it's a mathematical equation that works for some people, doesn't work for others.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, you do this division of the pounds and then the inches, and then you times it by either 703 or 705, depending on who you ask.
Right.
And then you get a number, and then that determines your BMI.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of an offshoot of the height weight, but I think you can't use other methods either. You can't necessarily use a waist-to-hip ratio on a child. That's not going to work very well. That it really only works on adults.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's you have to kind of look at the child, determine their percentile on the growth charts. The growth charts are also, however, based to some degree on BMI.
Right.
A little bit. So it's a little bit difficult. But you could look at somebody and say, okay, well, you're definitely overweight, so we know you're over fat. You, on the other hand, okay, say you're looking at another person and saying, okay, you look of normal weight, but yeah, you've got a little subcutaneous fat around the belly or something. It also depends on the age of the child. This gets more complicated because what if it's a 9 or a 12-year-old boy about to enter a growth spurt?
Yeah, maybe a little pudgy.
Or a 12-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl about to enter a growth spurt. So,
and
you know, what do we do there?
Let me illustrate because, you know, I actually applied this to my own case.
Mm-hmm.
And because when I was a kid, It was always embarrassing because I would go to buy blue jeans and the salesman would say to my mother, perhaps your son would be more interested in looking at the husky section. And this is, of course, a great source of humiliation for me that I was husky. I mean, it's actually thwarted my emotional development to this day. I mean, that's what, you know, but
we remember all those insults, don't we?
Yeah, I go three times a week to the psychiatrist. It still doesn't help. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But it's traumatic for a kid to get that verdict. Okay, so sure. So I plugged in my height and weight at approximately the age of 11. Because before that pubertal growth spurt, which fortunately turned me into a taller string bean kind of physiognomy. And then, you know, I never looked back. I was never fat after that. But, you know, perhaps I was a little pudgy. You know, maybe I was a little too much of an egghead, not physically active enough as a kid, although I did run around a lot. I didn't engage in sports. But, you know, as kids, we just ran around. You know, we played, we had sword fights with 2x4s and garbage can lids. We didn't have sophisticated toys. But anyway, so at 11, so I used a plug-in for children on BMI. And I remember that at the age of 11, I was short. I was 4'10". And I was about 90 pounds. So I plugged it in, and I got the verdict of this. Let's say, you know, Ronald Hoffman was an 11-year-old child in 2014, and, you know, mom decided to plug it in that way, or the pediatrician decided to plug it in. And I got, like, a very strongly worded warning that I was in the 86th percentile of weight for my height. And and you know, in terms of age appropriate, and I was in the red zone. There was actually the sort of, you know, green, yellow, red. I was in the red zone. I was actually had just barely crossed the threshold into the statistic of obesity. And I wonder, you know, this kind of goes to the argument of those fat letters that they send home with kids these days, like, you know, warning.
Oh, my gosh, that's a new thing, right?
Right. You know, we're going to call Child Protective Services because your child is, you know, subject to food abuse at home. And
you're buying too many Doritos, Mom.
Right. You're a bad parent, you know, it's traumatic for the child. And basically, you know, I grew out of it. And so, I don't know how valuable this kind of assessment is. I mean, yes, we do need to do better with our kids, but
I don't think it's a valuable assessment at all, because every child at some point, they go through that tiny bit of an awkward prepubescent stage of, you could almost call it baby fat. A lot of kids don't go through this, but it's right before that amazing growth spurt.
Right. Because it's this little thing, two great hormones, one's estrogen and one's testosterone, and that really changes your body shape, you know, hopefully for the better. So, all right.
Yeah.
So anyway, I take these studies with a grain of salt, and, you know, of course, it's very sensationalistic to say it's the obesity epidemic is even worse than we once thought among our children. But, you know, clearly our children eat too much junk, and they're not physically active enough, and we need to do better. All right, so the next story that is perturbing is, and I you saw it as well, it's from the Environmental Working Group, EWG, which is a pretty cool organization, because we actually use that organization a lot to highlight toxic cosmetics and to tell patients about
seafood,
the mercury in fish. We use their mercury counter at EWG.org. For our patients to help inform them as to which fish are preferable to eat. But this headline, it's like a real attention-grabbing headline, which is that kids are overdosing on vitamins.
Yeah.
So what's your take on that one?
Well, you know, they talk about the processed food. They're talking about fortification in foods like cereals and breads and so forth. And really what they're talking about is all the processed food. Children, first of all, what they're using, they're spraying vitamins on cereal. I mean, you could spray vitamins on cardboard. Is that essentially good for you? No.
Your vitamin fortified Count Chocula cereal, you know.
Exactly.
Now with, you know, B vitamins or whatever.
So the concept of too many vitamins, look at the source. If anything, they're sprayed on a bunch of so-called food that could be classified as anti-nutrients.
Right.
It's all a lot of corn, or like we like to call cornography. A lot of,
like
a lot of sugar-laden products, because that's going to zap your B vitamins and magnesium anyway. So you know what? You better fortify that Count Chocula or whatever other cereal.
Right.
But I doubt any child would OD on vitamins from fortified foods. If anything, they're ODing on sugar and refined carbohydrates and other nasty things like preservatives, some of them carcinogens. BHA, BHT is in cereals, for instance. So there's a whole lot more to be afraid of there than the fortification.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think it inherently, I'm not here to advocate for vitamin-fortified processed cereals, but the notion that the small smattering of vitamins that they put on those cereals is putting children at risk is absurd. So, for example, they cite the potential hazards of excess vitamin A. But the hazards of excess vitamin A are applicable to pregnant women or, you know, if older women take a really high dose of vitamin A, they might, and this is actually not conclusively proven, but there's a theory that that can promote osteoporosis. But this would have to be very high doses of vitamin A, the retinol form of vitamin A. And that's not nearly what you see in those cereals. So they're sort of extrapolating. They say, well, those vitamins at high doses are toxic, so the tiny amounts that are on children's cereals could be toxic. But there's no evidence that they're toxic. And in fact, there's a lot of kids who are really finicky eaters, and they're eating basically junk food. And maybe their only exposure to some critical nutrients like vitamin D and zinc and selenium, hopefully there's some selenium in there, some B vitamins, comes from these cereals, you know.
That's
and
true.
Maybe, you know, there's some net good to be had, that there's at least some fortification, not that it's my preferred form of childhood nutrition. You know, I just thought when they said niacin, did you know, Layla, did you know that niacin can be very dangerous? It can cause flushing, and it can cause liver problems.
Flushing? Well, how much niacin?
Exactly. They're not putting, like, you know, 500 milligrams of niacin.
It's not 500 milligrams.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah, right, right.
That's ridiculous, their claim.
Right. So it's like, gee, you know, it's more likely if you're going to have flushing from a cereal, it'll be due to a reaction to the preservatives and artificial ingredients in it.
Yeah. You know? Breakout in hives and everything else.
Right.
Right.
It's quite possible. So, you know, I got to say, I mean, you know, I like EWG. But,
I do. I'm very disappointed that they printed something like this.
It's
actually
a sensationalistic thing. They got headlines, and it's sort of in that sort of anti-vitamin, anti-supplement fervor. And I actually have reached out to EWG through the Alliance for Natural Health. They like the EWG, and they're sort of in league with the EWG about protecting our food sources and making sure our food is pure, our water is clean. And they're going to do a little bit of a back channel correction, hopefully, to that, so
good.
That they don't use this as a vitamin bashing kind of proposition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know what I wish was in those cereals? I wish there was some essential fatty acids in those cereals, but that would make.
I think there should be warnings on cereals, not about the, but the preservatives and the junky nature and the GMO. You know, all that pornography is genetically modified.
Yes. Yes.
So, for parents everywhere, just don't feed your kids processed food. It's not the fortification that worries us. It's the junk that you're feeding your children. If you feed them whole, unprocessed food the way it's found in nature and give them a sensible multivitamin, a little fish oil, a little vitamin D, they're going to be just fine.
Yeah. I'm not a big proponent of mega vitamin supplementation for children, unless special cases like children with various diseases or autism. You know, there might be a case for very targeted high-dose nutrition that's supervised by a nutritional professional. But, you know, I don't think kids need to take you know, those chewable multis, they're garbage mostly.
Gummies,
And chewable vitamin C takes the enamel off your teeth, and I'm not a big fan of that kind of thing. Vitamin D, omega-3 fatty acids, maybe, you know, for kids, maybe some zinc for kids who are susceptible to infections. Probiotics, I like that.
But absolutely,
All right, I'm not, you know, I'm not too impressed with this particular EWG media blast. You know, it's like summertime, let's do a scare story.
Oh, boy.
It's like, you know, Jaws.
Yeah.
It's a great summertime movie, you know, it's like. All right, so let's get to some of our questions.
Okay, okay. This comes from, let me see, from Jean and John. Or it's either Jean or John. I'd love to hear Dr. Hoffman discuss sleep apnea. a friend said that this condition may cause or make worse osteoporosis, diabetes, fatty liver disease, cancer, pneumonia, and more, not because you don't sleep well, but because there is low blood oxygen. Is that possible? If so, why don't they get everyone tested the way they give you colonoscopies and mammograms?
Right. Well, that's a good question. And, you know, for listening audience not familiar with sleep apnea is a breathing condition that occurs at night, and it disturbs sleep, and it causes you not to sleep as deeply. You'll have frequent awakenings at night, and this can be determined in a sleep laboratory, although I'm encouraged by some of the apps that are now available. You know, we're really moving into the app era that people will be able to do self-testing, and some of the apps are a little hokey, but I think more and more people will be able to self-test for sleep apnea, although there are actually some monitors that can be sent home with patients by physicians. You know, going to a sleep lab, it's not really a very natural way of mimicking your usual sleep pattern. So I think that we'll be able to detect it. So these frequent awakenings, they can sometimes be noticed by a partner. But all too often, I ask people, does anybody observe your sleep? And people say, no, I live alone, I'm single, and, you know, so nobody knows, you know, what's going on. Do you snore? Well, not all snorers have sleep apnea, but snoring is a tip-off for potential sleep apnea. If someone has real pauses and they gasp at night and they seem not to breathe, sometimes that's actually scary for the partner witnessing this. That's very likely they have sleep apnea. So what does sleep apnea do? Well, first of all, it deprives you of deep sleep. As you know, Layla, that can cause sleep deprivation. So people seem to log the requisite amount of time in bed, but they don't actually have restful sleep. It's interrupted frequently. They don't get into deep REM sleep. And the consequences are that they feel tired in the morning. They often fall out or fall asleep while driving. I would say that a major cause of automobile accidents is people have sleep apnea that's not been properly treated or detected. The other thing it does, it actually will create an uptick in your sympathetic nervous system, almost like putting you into a constant stress pattern. It will raise your cortisol and will raise your adrenaline. So we have some patients who have high blood pressure on account of sleep apnea.
And I think that's one of the first clues. Besides never feeling completely rested and refreshed in the morning,
So, and you could say a myriad of problems could be triggered in the body, including, you know, brain deterioration, because we know that sleep deprivation can accelerate dementia, and certainly it has bad effects on the heart. And the problem with sleep apnea is that a lot of obese individuals have sleep apnea, so they have, you know, double trouble. They have the metabolic obesity problems, you know, hypertension, prediabetes, high cholesterol, and, you know, schlepping around a lot of weight, and then they don't sleep well, and it's just like a double whammy.
Yeah. So losing the weight can actually help to reverse all of that. When there's especially a lot of fat accumulation around the neck or in the upper body, that can certainly exacerbate.
Yeah, I always say that for men, you know, if you're wearing a size 17 or 18 shirt, that's a risk factor for sleep apnea, because it means that your airway may be crowded with subcutaneous fat that accumulates around your, you know, double chin. And weight loss often helps, but there's a small percentage of sleep apnea patients, considerable minority, who have sleep apnea despite their thinness, and they may have palatal abnormalities, you know, which causes their mouth not to close properly and, you know, cause snoring or cause blockage.
Yeah, the soft palate to obstruct.
Or alternatively, they may have what's called central sleep apnea, which is it's a neurological condition. It's in the brain, and it has to do with, you know, there's some brain abnormality that causes them not to breathe properly. So, you know, actually the type of physician who specializes in sleep apnea, it's usually a subspecialty of pulmonary medicine. So if you're concerned about sleep apnea, see a pulmonary physician, and they know how to evaluate it. They're actually specialists in sleep apnea, and they're sleep centers at major university hospitals. So should everybody be tested? Well, I got to say that, you know, as with many interesting new medical conditions, there's a little bit of a vogue for diagnosing sleep apnea. So it's sort of like, you know, Lyme disease. It's a little bit like osteoporosis. You know, now that we have the technology to diagnose it and we have treatments available, there's a little bit of a rush to diagnose it and then treat it. because, you know, once having identified it, I think doctors have some skin in the game to make that diagnosis, especially specialists, and then to offer help. I mean, that's nice. It's altruistic. It's also a little bit self-aggrandizing because, you know, then they get to, you know, turn a ordinary person into a patient, or a patient that may have minor sleep problems, you know, is diagnosed with that, gets an expensive and cumbersome apparatus for sleep, and then is, you know, undergoing all kinds of medical interventions.
I would also, and I just want to make a clarification. I think Jean or John, whoever is asking this question, is concerned about why aren't we being tested, all of us being tested for low blood oxygen in this regard. But that low blood oxygen doesn't last all day. It's only during the apnea episode. So how would you ever, you know? The other thing is, you know, I've heard of people sitting up in their easy chairs to sleep with a travel pillow around their necks. And I often wonder, Dr. Hoffman, because sometimes it's a matter of that soft palate obstructing. You know, how about lying down and sleeping on a massage table where there's actually room, there's a hole where your face would go? So you're literally sleeping on your belly and your face is also down, but your face is not obstructed because there's a hole there on the table.
Yeah,
either
that
or learn to play that Australian horn instrument. I forget what it's called, but it's really long. It's some kind of a horn.
And it's great for breath control.
And it's great for breath control. And it can help to tighten up the palate and the throat.
Or just take up singing, you know, just join a choir. It's great for breath control. I mean, maybe that's, you know, part of a holistic regimen for people who suffer from sleep apnea.
Yeah.
Look, I mean, it's a serious problem. We deal with it. Mostly the nutritional angle on it is to simply get people to lose weight. And there's a very close concordance between metabolic syndrome and sleep apnea. And it's one of those chicken and egg things. The sleep apnea worsens the metabolic syndrome, and the metabolic syndrome, because it causes fat accumulation, worsens the sleep apnea, and you get into a vicious cycle. And we try to break the vicious cycle. Sometimes we're very successful on that.
Right.
All right.
Okay. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, that was a good question. Good. So this is a logical break point for us, because we usually separate our podcast into two segments. So let's stipulate this is part one of this week's Q&A with Layla. When we return, we got several more questions to tackle. What's coming up in part two?
In part two, we have a question about urinary tract infection and E. coli.
Okay. So looking forward to that in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. It's Q&A with Layla, and this is Intelligent Medicine.